This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Death and All His Friends, themes of death, dying and grief in speculative fiction.
So, death.
It's the ultimate promise, isn't it? It is. As I was saying to Madeleine just now, it's basically the one thing we can all guarantee we're going to do. We're going to experience it at some point.
Something that we all have in common. And if some of us don't have it in common, speak up, please.
Speak up.
Share.
But it's worth, I think, obviously looking at, because this is something that's been explored in basically proto-speculative fiction, so myths and legends that date back thousands of years, and possibly even before that, if you look at oral tales, there'll be themes where death was cheated or persuaded otherwise, or in some way nullified by other powers that are just as nebulous. And there is a very definite personification or anthropomorphism of death as a conscious entity who either just is doing a job and feels, you know, pretty bad about it most of the time, or is quite a kindly presence but utterly inexorable. You can't do anything about it. Or somebody who, the ultimate outcast, the ultimate person who is on the outside looking in for eternity.
It makes me think of, I think one of the most striking parts of Nordic mythology is, I don't know if you know the myth where it's Thor, Loki and someone else are off and they encounter these group of giants who set them these tasks, and at first the Asgardians lose every single task, but then at the end it's revealed that they were tricked. So for instance, Loki, they had an eating contest, but the other guy won because he also ate through the table as well as everything on the table.
Yeah.
And he was actually, that guy was revealed to be a fire or something like that. And Thor had to wrestle an old woman, but no matter how hard he tried against her, she would always bring him to his knees. And then later on it was revealed that she was time, and how time would eventually, no matter who you were, no matter how strong you were, would eventually defeat you. And I think that was the first time I encountered the personification of death in a way that defeated even these gods. We know death is coming for humans, but there is a kind of immortality aspect that you apply to gods and then beings of power. And it was the first time I'd encountered this idea that no, death is actually in the end the ultimate thing that everybody shares, and no one can actually escape it.
Absolutely. I mean, there's obviously biblical tales as well. The last to die shall be death. I mean, obviously this is leaning more towards an Abrahamic religion afterlife, but it's the fact that you have Uriel, the angel of death, the story of the Passover in Egypt, when Moses was trying to free the enslaved Hebrews and they all anointed their doors with the blood of a lamb, so that the angel of death would pass over them, and the firstborn of all the sons of Egypt were killed in a single night, or were taken by the angel of death in a single night. So, you know, whatever credence you put in that story or not, as the case may be, it's still a very clear personification of death as an actual entity.
I don't know if you've... Well, I don't know why I'm asking this. Of course you've read it. The Book Thief.
I was going to say, The Book Thief is on my list. It's Marxistic, and it's absolutely fantastic. It's a very, very good book. Basically,
I'm hard to press to find a book you haven't read, Jules.
there's thousands of them. There's thousands. I will die beside a pile of books that I want to read and won't ever get the chance to. That is my destiny. But The Book Thief is actually, in the same manner that The Great Gatsby is, narrated by someone who is really outside the events, who is a very much a bit part, so an indirect narrator, if you like, somebody who is narrating the events of the story because he witnessed them. Mm-hmm. And it's narrated by Death. And Death, this is during the Second World War, it's set in Germany, and he is narrating the events as he sees them. And he can't help it because he's become fascinated by a young girl called Liesl Memminger, who can't read, she's illiterate at the beginning of the story, but she steals a book called The Gravedigger's Manual because it's a book and she's fascinated by them. And it, you know, you have her mother being taken away to, not sure if it's Auschwitz, but it's one of the camps, and essentially she's her mother's killed for being half Polish, I think, and we're not sure about her religion, but and Liesl's too young at the time to really know. And she loses her brother at the same time. He dies on the train that's supposed to be taking them somewhere. And Liesl gets adopted by a German family, or rather a husband and wife who don't have any children of their own. And it's just such a brilliant book, because even though death is supposed to be impartial, and he says, I say he, because he's neither male nor female, really.
No.
But he is better than it. And obviously you get into problematic territories with pronouns when you go gender neuter. So so say he for the sake of argument. It's just a case of I think it drives the message home so much more and makes it so much more poignant when you have death, the ultimate impartial observer, looking at the horrors of the Second World War and of the concentration camps and the bombs being dropped on, you know, basically innocent villages and towns in Germany as well as England and everywhere else. And there's one passage where he's talking about a particular battle. I think it's not the D-Day landings, it's something else, but he said he had to carry so many souls, 20 in his arms at a time, and they draped over him like linen and cobweb, and he could barely see his way, but he was carrying so many. Yeah, it's the fact that he is feeling something as close as he can possibly feel to human grief, because he's become fascinated with Liesl, and it's made him more interested in humans in general. It makes it a lot more poignant, and it drives home the pointlessness of it all.
I think there are two passages in that book which really stuck with me, and the one you've just mentioned is definitely a scene which is quite poignant. But for me, there are two, and one is about death, and the other is actually about something that's very human. The first is the most obvious, and it's the way the book ends, with death basically saying, "I am haunted by humans."
Yeah.
Which is an incredible statement, but it links in with this other scene that happens, where a fighter pilot crash lands in the village, or just outside of the village, and it's actually an English fighter pilot, it's not a German one, and he's dying in his cockpit, he's trapped and he's bleeding out, and everyone gathers to see him. And even though technically they're enemies, as far as, you know, the state, as far as the countries are concerned, they see this man dying, and the boy, one of the children, goes forward and he brings this man a teddy bear.
It's Rudy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Rudy. And the dying pilot just hugs this teddy bear as he's dying and then passes away. And they all just kind of comfort him, even though there's this language barrier. And to me, even there are several scenes in the book which just tear your heart out. But for me, that cemented something incredibly strong, which then links in with the whole humans haunt me. And it was this unity, whereby there was a person dying, and that was all there was to it. He wasn't the enemy. He wasn't someone who they had to be afraid of. He wasn't afraid of them either, because in that moment, that was the last, you know, the only thing that could be taken from him at that point, his life, was being taken, and he was passing away. And because of that, nothing else mattered. They all just sort of came together. And I think that that's incredible, that the unification that comes with death, and the fact that everybody is going to die.
Yeah.
And we sort of were reminded of that, and yet even though it's the only guaranteed thing, which is definitely going to happen in all of our lifetimes, we're still very, it's still the ultimate thing, it's still used as the ultimate thing against us, even though it's the one thing that unifies us. And when it came down to it, I just, that scene, it sticks with me, it haunts me. I love it.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. Not to Not to blow my own trumpet, it just reminded me of a line I wrote in a book that I've just written with Matt Willis, which is A Black Matter for the King, and the character Alf Giefer has stepped forward, and she doesn't like the person who's dying, but she says, "And I gave him the last gift that one human being can give another, which is not to let them die feeling alone." Yeah. And it's the same thing, a case of beyond everything, beyond all barriers that we erect during life as it stands, it is a case of there's someone there to hold your hand as you cross over.
Yeah.
And the same with the pilot in that scene. I mean, it's much more poignant in the sense of they're on different sides in a really bitter and brutal war, which is senseless and insane.
Yeah, no, but again, I guess the reason it also cements itself so strongly in my mind is that it's a scene that feels very real, in that the one thing that defeats hatred and fear is death, in some ways.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the two great powers, shall we say, but we'll talk about the other one in a bit. Talking of personifications of death, obviously a famous example is Death from the Discworld series. He's just called Death, strangely enough. And he's a 7-foot-tall skeleton with glowing blue eyes and a death's head grin, which he can't really help being, as he's a skeleton.
And he always speaks in capitals.
He always speaks in capitals, because he is the voice of death. but he's absolutely fabulous as a character, and I think everybody who's a real Pratchett fan feels that I'm making a bit of a cop-out when I say that he is probably my favourite Discworld character, because, you know, in a way, he's both more real and not real than every other character. But yeah, what I love about him is the fact that he's not really trying to be human so much as he's trying very, very hard to understand. He's aware that he would stop existing if people stopped anthropomorphizing him. And at the same time, he rather likes cats and flowers, and it doesn't matter what anybody's done. He always treats them politely when he takes them along, when their hourglasses run out. And there are times when he interferes, like in The Hogfather, where it's important to him that belief in something greater than themselves remains amongst the humans. So he actually takes on the role of the Hogfather for the night, which is the Discworld version of Santa Claus. So if you imagine Death with a pillow stuffed down his red suit, trying very hard to be jolly and not really getting it right, it's extremely funny. Because if Father Christmas is also another anthropomorphism, so you've got one anthropomorphism playing the other for an evening. And he also does weird things, like he adopts somebody. You know, there's that great line in Mort where it says, "Death comes to us all, but when he came to Mort, he offered him a job."
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Mort becomes Death's apprentice. But of course, Mort is still mortal, and when he marries, he and his wife die and leave behind a granddaughter, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan has got the sort of death legacy behind her, but she desperately wants to be normal, so she sort of cuts off ties with him. And I mean, he goes into a depression when his adopted son-in-law and daughter-in-law die, and when his granddaughter's away at boarding school.
Aww. I haven't read that.
He goes off and joins what's effectively the French Foreign Legion. And they're really trying to break him down and make him tougher. And it's like he sort of gets drunk and just keeps saying that nothing's really hard enough. Haven't they got anything else to throw at him? And the captains are all scratching their heads and getting really quite upset by the fact that the worst they throw at him isn't doing anything to him at all, which it can't, because he's not alive.
Yeah, and with Mort, it's the one line in Mort that I really, really like, where he says, "What is your name?" And Mort goes, "Mort," and he goes, "Really? What a coincidence."
And there's also the bit in Reaper Man, which is a very tongue-in-cheek retelling of Death and the Maiden, whereby he knows the woman is going to die, but she's got a little bit of time left, and he thinks she's had rather a shit life. So he sort of courts her a little bit, rather than just taking her away. He's decided he's having a holiday in the country, you see. And he goes to work on a farm, and it's this old lady, and he He's like, well, what do women like? Flowers, chocolates, jewellery? And he goes away and he says, one of the jewellers says, oh yeah, diamonds are a woman's best friend. And he comes back with a huge diamond for her and says, I have brought you a diamond to be friendly with. So, I mean, he's just the absolute best character in some ways because he's not human.
And yet I think that another reason Death is so popular is that we're very comforted by that version of him. Because we think of Death and you think skeleton and it's quite frightening. And then he's the opposite of that. And that's kind of what we want, because we're all afraid of Death. Because simply because we don't know what happens next. If anything happens next. And I think some people are frightened of the possibility that it won't. I think some people are actually kind of comforted by it. But,
yeah. Topic that.
Yeah, that'll go into something else. yeah, we like the idea of a friendly Death who maybe isn't human, because actually it wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for Death to be human, because it wouldn't actually be very comforting, because humans are kind of infallible and don't understand what's going on, and we want someone who does understand what's going on, and if they did understand, then by definition they couldn't really be human.
No. And then obviously you have books like Robin Lefevre's His Fair Assassin series, which mm-hmm. is three books: Grave Mercy, Dark Triumph, and Mortal Heart, and it's a different main character in each one. And basically, they're women who've been wronged, who've joined this order of assassins. They're all female assassins, and they're known as the Handmaidens of Death. They serve Death as a god. And it's set in, I think, 14th century Burgundy. So there's some historical content as well. Obviously, they're bending it quite a bit with the different gods, but then it is really, really interesting. But Death is very much an actual presence in that. He is not a god as in a concept. It's a god who occasionally turns up and says, well, actually, what you've been told isn't strictly correct. That's someone imposing religion on you. I just exist like this, and you need to make the best choice. And it's not necessarily wrong to kill in my name, but are you killing? What are you killing for? In some cases, it's a case of taking people out who are too dangerous to be allowed to continue to live, because they will do exponentially more damage.
Yeah.
Which can be a bit of a wobbly one, because that's a major god complex right there. And in some cases, it's a case of killing out of mercy, because people are suffering and they're ready to go.
It's a this isn't a book thing, but my mother was staying at a hospital, and I'm pretty sure it's this one. It's the Val de Grâce in France, in Paris. And they have this amazing sculpture on the side of the building, which is a man holding up his hand, and he's pushing back Death, who is advancing on him, and he's pushing back the scythe. The picture surfaced on Tumblr, of course, and everyone said, how conceited do you have to be as a hospital to literally have a sculpture of someone pushing back Death? But I saw a very different kind of meaning to it, because it wasn't man defeating Death. It was man holding him at bay, which is, I think, the best thing that we that we as humans can possibly do. That's about it. We can only hold him at bay, because he's coming either way. But it is interesting that in most renditions, Death remains the same visually, even if he, you know, has a different kind of character from what we perceive. He is usually shown as a skeleton in a dark cloak with a scythe. Don't know why a scythe, but because I think it used to be a sword, but reason a scythe.
Because he is the Reaper.
But why is he the Reaper? Is he the Reaper because he has the scythe, or did he have the scythe because he was named the Reaper?
I think it was a case of at some point, so after the grain revolution of 10,000 years ago, some clever dick said basically that he cuts down men like corn.
Oh.
I mean, he used to be a sickle, not a scythe, because we didn't actually have a scythe. I'm sure if you really looked into what instruments he's supposed to have, because he is pictured with a sword as well. The Angel of Death is pictured with a sword.
Yeah.
There's all these.
Do you think he keeps getting upgrades? What do I have now? An AK-47. Right.
There's all these different things. There is a bit of crossover. There's a thin line between the anthropomorphized skeleton Death and gods like Hades or the Lord of the Underworld in the Astarte or Ishtar myths, in the Song of Solomon. And they're not actually pictured as skeleton or are actually in any way deformed. They're just pictured as, you know, god-type creatures. And it's somebody has to be overlord of the underworld. I mean, Hades was very much tricked into it by his brother Zeus.
But Hades is such a giant nerd.
He's a nerd.
He's a nerd. First of all, he's not the god of death, because that's Kronos. No. Thanos. Thanos.
Yeah, Thanos.
Hades is a nerd. Hades talks to his flowers, and he's apparently the greatest flaw anyone could find with him, with all the Greek gods who are running around, you know, bonking everything that moves, or murdering everybody. Hades was pretty chill, to be honest. In fact, like, he's always described as kind of dull, because he just didn't do any of that stuff. He was the most responsible of all of them. He never killed anybody. He was actually pretty nice, to be honest.
Yeah.
So, kudos to Hades. He also wasn't the god of death.
Well, no, he did become the god of death, because Thanos was a titan, and the titans were all defeated, so somebody had to take over the role.
I just thought he was technically just the god of the underworld.
He is lord of the underworld.
I thought Thanos was allowed to continue running about.
Well, technically so was Kronos, but they did have them imprisoned somewhere. Most of the titans were destroyed, but they were also... Zeus imprisoned them. I can't remember where now. Anyway.
In Tartarus.
Yeah, probably.
Except for Calypso, who got an island.
Yes.
Anyway, we're not talking about Greek myths. Yeah.
Death and the Maiden concept, where, you know, you have this very, very lonely character who basically is going to kill everything he touches, and this very beautiful maiden who's the epitome of youth and health and can still fall to death. And the whole idea is he falls in love with the maiden kind of thing. But obviously he's going to kill her if he goes anywhere near her, which is, you know, a bit of a bind on a relationship. Yeah. But that all originated with the myth of Cora, or again, you can say Cora, Ishtar, Astarte, Persephone descending to the underworld. And there is a later myth of Persephone being abducted. I can't remember which playwright it was now. One of the playwrights, possibly Aristotle. No, not Aristotle. Anyway.
Might have been Aristotle.
It might have been Aristotle.
I really liked Aristotle until I found out he was super sexist.
Yeah. He wrote a play called The Rape of Persephone, where Hades sees her picking wildflowers and hitches up his chariot, and the earth breaks open at her feet. And he carries her off, which is where you get the myth of winter, because Demeter grieves, obviously. That's slightly beside the point. But really, the original myth, it's a case of Cora finds a path to the underworld and thinks, I'm going to explore this. And she gets down there and pretty much sets up shop. And the lord of the underworld is kind of like, so you're staying then? And she's like, yeah, I like this. I'm going to be queen of here. And he's like, well, okay then.
I do love this idea that she's just prancing around and he's just in the shadows, like, nearby, like, okay.
She's like, she moves in and basically says, I like this, it's going to be my kingdom, I like you, you're going to be my king. And she becomes a regeneration goddess, where she is a goddess of death, but also of rebirth. And is extremely feared, and her name was not supposed to be spoken aloud except in secret by her priests and priestesses. You know, the Lord of the Underworld is very much a case of, I guess I'll do what she says then.
But he totally adores her. I mean,
I mean, he tests her to begin with. He tells her to lay down her jewellery, which she does. And then he says, there's some weird bits as well, depending on which myth you go with, and says that she has to lay down the rest of her adornments. So she walks on into the underworld clad only in her long flowing hair. And then there's a physical sort of, well, you know, your beauty's too great. So he's kind of going to ruin it by scourging her. But he's already fallen in love with her, and he can't quite bring himself to do it properly. And she falls in love with him at that point. Anyway, it all gets very, very weird. And it's kind of like, at this point in the relationship, we probably don't want to be looking at that bit too hard. We'll just go with the whole, you've decided you want to set up shop here, and you've told him he's going to be your king.
He's about to scourge out. He's about to scourge her, and she's there like, you know what? I like you.
It's like, I think we should get married.
He puts down scourge. Good. Fantastic.
The exact words from the translation are, but he scourged her but lightly, and she cried out, "And now I do know the pangs of love." So, you know, make of that what
they had sex. Really. They had sex, Jules. That's what that was about. Confirmed. Okay.
But that's where this death and the maiden type myth comes from, which is one that I've always found quite fascinating.
I was going to mention a completely different...
Sorry about that.
Very different, but Monty Python and the Meaning of Life.
Yes.
I just want to talk about death in that version. And death in that version did something interesting, which was that death couldn't speak in that. He didn't speak. Did he speak?
I don't think so.
Or if he did speak, it was kind of more like... It wasn't really a voice, as it were. And they do the same with Mort. The reason Death talks in capitals is that he's actually talking straight into people's brains. He doesn't actually communicate because he doesn't have lips, because he's a skeleton. And I've always been kind of fascinated by this idea that appears several times in speculative fiction. It was also in the Odd Thomas series as well, where the dead cannot speak. The dead have no voices.
Yeah.
They can communicate, but they can't actually speak. And the idea of death being silent really intrigues me, that that's a detail that we decided to keep. And I wonder whether is it because when we speak to the dead, we don't get a response? Is that where that was born from? Or is there something else to it?
I think
what is it about it?
There's a slightly more esoteric route in the sense of, you know, breath being considered synonymous with life.
Yeah.
And once breath is gone, then you literally cannot speak. You can't speak if you can't breathe. So I think there's an element of that in there. But I don't know. It's an interesting point. And it is something that does seem to sort of permeate, because unwittingly, I've sort of included that in my book.
You have, actually, yes.
That the ghosts, as it were, speak pretty much directly into the main character's head. Which is why she can hear them and see them, and other people can't. She's on the right frequency.
You've also included something else in your book, which is the idea that even Emelina, give context to those who haven't had the fortune of reading I Belong to the Earth yet, she's basically a bit of a psychic medium. She can sense the dead, and she can communicate with them and do all sorts of other cool stuff. But interestingly enough, the premise of the story starts that Emmeline has lost her mother, and she and her family have gone off to live somewhere in the middle of nowhere to sort of kind of start up again, as it were. And her father's become uber Christian and is now a priest, reverend.
Yeah,
yeah, he's a vicar. There we go. And they end up in this place which is haunted, very, very, very haunted. And yet, the thing I kind of like most about it is that the ghost that Emmeline wants to see the most is the one she's kind of oblivious to.
Yes. Yes, and she's sort of protecting herself in a way. Because
yeah.
Because she can't quite forgive her mother.
I don't want to spoil anything here, but it's not like we ever see her mother. It's not like there's ever a ghostly apparition where her mother appears in a blaze of glory and tells her what to do. That never happens. But I found that choice was quite interesting, and again it did tie in with this idea that the dead are silent, and especially the wanting to communicate with the people who are absolutely closest to you is almost the hardest thing to do of all. She's meeting all these random ghosts who she really has nothing to do with, as it were,
yeah,
and who are pulling her into these things, but the actual ghosts that she wants to see are nowhere to be found. She can't communicate with them.
I mean, part of that is the fact that she hasn't really got an entire handle on her abilities. But part of it is the fact that we don't get given a lot of what we want in life.
No, this is true.
and yeah, she's not aware how furiously angry she still is, and the fact that she hasn't really forgiven her mother, even if her mother had died very naturally, which isn't what happened. She might still have not been able to forgive her for leaving her, because, you know, grief is not a rational emotion, and grief can completely change your outlook and can completely change you as a person for a long time.
And that leads us on to our next topic, which is the use of death in speculative fiction as a motivator.
Yeah. Well, we've spoken before about the girl in the refrigerator type trope, so we won't go into that too much, but that is a way of using a character's death probably in the wrong way in most cases,
mm-hmm.
whereby what you're doing is generating man pain for what is usually a male character to go off and just be motivated to do his story arc. And it's one that I find I've got less and less tolerance for the more I come across it.
Because something I tend to find in reality is death is not usually a great motivation to do stuff.
No.
In fact, death is usually a depressant.
Death kind of makes you want to not do stuff, in fact.
And usually what happens is that death makes you not want to do stuff, and then something else has to kind of make you confront death in a slightly different way. Now, I know I always talk about it. But let's talk about Harry Potter.
I always think of Harry Potter as well. So.
And we're going to talk about Sirius's death.
Yeah.
Because that was a very real reaction to me. In fact, it was the realest reaction to death that I'd ever seen in children's fiction. Because Harry literally does go through the five stages of grief, as it were. He does the whole bargaining thing with Nearly Headless Nick. And it ends with this great depression where he doesn't leave his room, basically, for days and days on end. The reason I actually really liked it was that Harry continued to function as a normal human being for the most part when he was out and about, despite going through this terrible pain.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Grief is a many-sided dice, and all those sides exist simultaneously, and I think some people can't quite get their heads around the fact that you can function as a normal human being, and at the same time, you don't really feel anything. You're moving through a fog or deep water.
And it's also this idea that the thing I don't really like is when people just say, you know, every day it was hard, every day it was, you know, this idea of constant grief. If people were constantly in grief, you know, if people were constantly feeling that bad, that people don't. And if they do, they tend to, you know, sorry, but they tend to kill themselves. I mean,
that is actually why we probably had so many Victorian widows falling into a decline and dying, because they were literally shut away and told to wear only dark colours and not receive visitors, that not go outside. That's where the whole widow's walk comes in architecture. Mm-hmm. And of an evening, the widow would be allowed to come out at sort of twilight, so not even under the sun, and walk along what would be a quite high up long balcony, just to take some air of an evening, because they were expected to make a great production of grief, particularly the well-bred ladies.
Yeah.
It's just incredibly unhealthy way. It's like, we don't talk about it, but we're going to make a theatre of the whole thing.
Yeah, and the thing is that grief doesn't tend to work in the way that you imagine it works. Grief tends to come in the day-to-day, tends to come in very insignificant ways. I think the interpretations of it that I appreciate the most are the small ones which kind of catch you off guard. And I remember it was a series called Cold Feet.
Yeah.
And at the end, James Nesbitt's wife dies in a car crash very, very suddenly. And he doesn't cry for ages. He just doesn't cry. And everyone's kind of almost a little bit appalled by it, because he seems to be working absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And he's almost hallucinating. He's not really hallucinating, but he's just kind of living in the day-to-day like his wife is still around.
Yeah.
And then at one point, he catches sight of his son walking for the first time, and his son is just crawling around. And he just stands there, and he crouches low and doesn't want to disturb his son, and he's just watching him. And he's imagining his wife beside him, and they're talking about it, and they're all excited. And then his wife suddenly says, "It's such a shame I'm not here to see this." And that's the blow, that's the one that hits him. And on a very real level, it's the tiny things like that. It's the moment where you set an extra place at the table. Because actually, for the most part, if you're constantly thinking about your loss, you wouldn't be able to get out of bed.
No.
And grief works. Actually, grief doesn't just loom over you. It kind of actually surprise attacks you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you're least expecting it.
I always, from personal experience, I always felt it was kind of like you're walking along and you're turning a corner, and then you just trip over this long oblong box that you haven't seen, and you keep finding it around odd corners and like barking your shins on it. And it's almost like you don't quite forget, but your brain protects itself by rearranging things so that it's not at the forefront of your mind, and then something happens to remind you again, which is where you're barking your shins on this box that just keeps appearing.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like going through an obstacle course, to be honest.
Yeah.
Grief. Because actually, it's like going through an obstacle course kind of blindfolded, and at first you're tripping up a lot because you're not used to it. And then after a time, you get used to sort of climbing over it and dealing with it. But occasionally, it does trip you up. It yeah. really does trip you up.
Well, I mean, it's less of a painful grief thing now. But my gran died when I was 19, which is quite a long time ago now. And I still occasionally think, oh, I must tell Nan that. And then remember that I can't actually tell her because she's not there and hasn't been for a very long time. It's just yeah. tiny things like that.
Well, I remember several months after I lost my mum, I was shopping with my dad and I came into Horsham. Horsham is our hometown. I hadn't been there for a few months. And I went up to where the Waitrose was and it was gone. They closed down and they'd moved somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I was there like, ugh. Called my dad and I was like, Dad, where's Waitrose? What's happening? And he was there like, what? And he came and we both stood there. And at the exact same time, looking at this closed Waitrose, we both thought, we've got to call Mum and tell her, so because when she comes shopping, she usually parks in a really difficult place so that it's accessible. And it was something we both thought. And then my dad kind of looked at me, he said, I just tried to he literally reached for his phone. I reached for mine. Both yeah. of us call her at the same time. And then we thought, oh, wait, that's not something we need to do. But it was that. It was actually the facing another problem that made us forget the initial problem, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how grief tends to work. Grief attacks you in the moments you're least expecting it. And so these renditions of people lying in bed day after day, I mean, don't get me wrong, that does also happen, but that does tend to also be linked then with depression of a different kind, other problems as well, other factors. But in the day to day, grief and trauma tend to manifest in ways that still allow you as a human being to operate on quite a high level.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's something that grief in speculative fiction particularly, although possibly in other places as well, but in speculative fiction, I think a lot of writers feel they have to dial it down a bit, as in the character will be really upset that somebody's died, and then in the next chapter they'll be getting on and doing something, and not in a, well, I'm functioning like a normal human being way, but actively tackling it as though nothing's happened. And then a couple of chapters down the road, when it's convenient, they'll remember that that person's died and be really upset about it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the other thing, which is, even as readers, as an audience member, if you have a character who's continually sort of moaning about the same thing, it's just yeah. like, oh, you kind of get a bit frustrated. You're like, oh, get over it. And then you're like, hold on a second.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it's a little bit like including a rape scene or something like that, because then you have to deal with the fallout of that, which is yeah. absolutely fine. But you're in danger of your epic fantasy novel becoming all about that. And it's the same with grief, I think. So it takes a lot of finesse to really manage it.
I think one of the best compliments I ever got on The Sound of Festian when I was writing it was someone said, you understand death very well. And that's a little bit distressing, but, but it was a great compliment.
Yeah.
And I you know, I'm when I first wrote it, I had never, no one in my family had actually ever died. I'd never experienced death in that way. And when I was editing it, however, I'd lost a great aunt, I'd lost my grandfather, and then my mother was dying, and we knew she was dying. And then she died just as it was about to come out. And oddly enough, it was through the editing that I think that came through. And this understanding of death, I wasn't sure at first what this person meant when they said that I understood death. But I guess, because not that many people die in the book, but I guess it was the way it was treated afterwards the way that the characters kind of dealt with it. Because at the end of the day, at the end of, you know, the Sons of Thestian, they've all got stuff to do. And they're all kind of a little bit like, we don't really want to do this stuff now because we just kind of need a moment. But they don't have time to have a moment, so they kind of just have to do it.
I think you can actually really see it in Rufus, though, because he starts off as... I mean, he's very much his own character, but he's being quite self-destructive.
Yeah.
And you can't really see a reason why. And it's almost like you've got the silhouette of the problem, but you don't really know... There's no detail filling in the silhouette, you know, what actually is... What's the root? What's this stemming from? And as you go through the book, a little bit more comes out and a bit more until you finally find out what it is. And it is very like that.
Well, the important thing to me was that people who are experiencing grief are still capable of telling jokes.
Yeah, you can still, you generally still will find something funny and you'll still carry on. You're not, it is only if you're in a major, major depression, which does happen, that you stop functioning altogether.
But the odd thing is that actually people who tend to be the most depressed tend to be also the funniest.
Yes, actually, to be fair.
So using death as a motivator is great, but death doesn't usually tend to be a fantastic motivator. And no. The whole vengeance route thing, I mean, we could have an entire episode about the vengeance route.
Yeah, maybe we should at some point. Yes, and that both works and doesn't work for lots of reasons. And I think when it doesn't work is when it's clearly the author has cheaply thrown a character away in order to provide a motivator. And that's quite a cheap motivation, really, despite somebody having died. Because your initial thought is not immediately, well, I'm going to go and track down this person. I do understand the whole, I need somebody to blame, I need somebody to fight.
Yeah. But at the same time...
It doesn't necessarily manifest itself quite like that. You don't immediately strap on your sword.
And it also tends to be a certain character who's going to react to death in that way. Not everybody is going to react to death in that way.
Yeah.
People absolutely behave differently. So,
I think it's a good point to look at how... Well, I was going to say, let's look at mortality versus immortality, which is something that comes up a lot in speculative fiction.
Yes.
Now, one argument is that immortality is best, as long as you get eternal youth with it.
Yeah.
You don't want the chthonic tale whereby you get eternal life, but you still age. That's not great.
That's definitely not great.
But, you know, immortality where perhaps you can be killed, but you won't naturally die, you won't age, you won't get old, is supposed to be something desirable. I actually find that moderately terrifying, because I think anything that lasts that long would be so far from human and so far from humane ultimately that the thing that had been saved and made immortal would no longer actually be that person by the end of their character arc, if there is an end.
Yeah.
Whereas you could argue that while mortality has, you know, the 1001 natural shocks that human flesh is heir to attached to it, to quote Hamlet, it makes existence and life precious, because death in a way is a gift that is only given to those who are mortal, which is why you have this whole huge dichotomy where you have immortals envying the mortals for their mortality and vice versa.
Yeah. Well, I always see it like this, is that actually most of our morality comes from our mortality. We are governed by the fact that we are going to die. And I also think that we are able to adapt and we are able to survive and grow as a species because we have a time limit. And it's this thing which is, we actually tend to perform quite well under pressure. You know, you look at your phone, like, oh God, I've got 80 years to get all this done. And
deadline!
The ultimate deadline. It's in the word. And because of that, actually, everything is more precious and we do take care of stuff better. I mean, sometimes you look around and we're really not taking care of stuff at all. And there's definitely a bad aspect that comes with mortality, in that people also tend to, you look at the state of our planet, you know, a few generations before us, you know, it was foretold this is going to happen. And they think, well, I'm not the one who's going to have to deal with it. So I'm just going to live in the way that I want to live.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to worry about the future. whereas immortals would probably be a little bit more responsible because they do have to worry about the future. So it's the two sides of it. And then it begs the question, what is it that makes us human? And is it the fact that we are ultimately going to die?
I think at some point, as a hypothetical immortal, you would lose the ability to feel. You would have to, because psychologically you would not be able to survive the sum total of year on year of constant sufferings.
Yeah.
You know, I think you would just become something like a rock, really. I'm not explaining that very well.
No, I completely get what you mean. I think one of my favourite short stories, my brother told me about this, it's this story that actually all of humanity is one person just being reborn over and over and over and over again. And at the end of it, at the end of all of that, that person is that then becomes, either then becomes God, or then becomes the companion for God. And you can't be God until you've experienced everything, literally yeah. everything that a mortal life can have to offer from all over the entire world. And on the one side, that's kind of a lonely feeling, because you think, am I just talking to myself right now then? No matter who I'm talking to, it's just another version of myself. But on the other hand, there is again, that's almost a comfort in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of a passage from Aradia, the Gospel of the Witches, where it is, you know, our purpose is to know all things, to experience all things, to suffer all things, to know and love and to return. I'm paraphrasing a little bit at the end there, but that's essentially what this 15th century witchcraft Bible, if you like, says. And it's very interesting to see it portrayed in literature. I will talk about, this is a weird one actually, but grieving your own death in literature, well, not just literature, in speculative fiction, because if you think about it, there are characters who do physically die for a moment and then come back and have to deal with the trauma of that.
Yeah.
If you take, we'll go for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the first time she died, she comes back and she's kind of a mess because she was 16 and she died. She had this whole role thrust on her she didn't want and still hasn't really reconciled herself with, and goes and does what she's supposed to do, and she does die and is clearly traumatised by it afterwards. So yeah. It's a case of she hasn't had a chance to grieve herself, which sounds insane, but actually it's really not.
I think that's also echoed by Dean Winchester in Supernatural, season 2, beginning of season 2. He's supposed to die, and his father gives his life to bring Dean back.
Yeah.
And Dean doesn't feel right for pretty much the entire season until, well, he gives up his life in order to save Sam. So it's, you know, it's a gruesome cycle.
Yes. doesn't feel like he really belongs. And this is something that, in a book I've literally just finished reading, which is A Court of Mist and Fury by Sarah J. Maas. I won't go into it in too much detail now, but Feyre is not in good shape at the beginning of that book. And if you haven't read A Court of Thorns and Roses, I'm going to spoilify it now by saying that Feyre does actually die at the end of that book. Very briefly. There's a reason she doesn't go further than she actually does, but defeats Amarantha, who is the evil fairy queen, and is tortured to death. And she's already been tortured a fair bit in the Court of Nightmares, and she dies, and she thinks she should have died as well. There's this huge weight of guilt because she's had to kill quite a lot of innocent people to get where she is, to actually free everybody. But she doesn't die, and she comes back, and she has to live with it. And she not only has to live with it, she has to pretend that she's okay and that she is living her happily ever after. And the problem is that having gone through death, the person who goes in is not the same person who comes out, because once you've been that close to actually dying, you are not the same person anymore.
No.
You can't be. There'll be elements of the old person. So it's a case of you're grieving the person you used to be. And a lot of it is a case of you've left part of yourself behind in death. And that's okay. You'll get better. But you need time. And a lot of people don't understand that. Mm. And obviously I've talked about something quite esoteric there without going into too much detail. But... But that's essentially what's happened to Feyre, and she's in a very deep depression because she's living with everything that the her of the pre-death her went through and did, but she's trapped now. She's immortal and she has to live with it forever, and she has got no idea how she's going to do that.
And I think it's also an element of the fact that she didn't just die. She died and she emerged as not only emotionally someone different, physically somebody different.
Yeah.
She died a human, and she emerged as a fae.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, for someone who at the beginning of the book really didn't like the fae, that's got to be a bit of a slap in the face, to be honest. So it's adding insult to injury, that not only has she having to deal with this entire change in her psyche for what she's done, she's also then for having to adjust to a life that she was not built for, she was not prepared for, and which, as far as, because I read your review, Jules, Tamlin isn't actually really helping her adjust. He's just kind of sort of hiding her away a bit.
Yeah, like a child, greedy child with sweets. He's just keeping her shut away and not helping her to adjust, because really what he wants was the person who, before she died, not the person after.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a different subject. But yeah, you're right. And she is dealing with the fact that her body is alien to her, but part of her is still mortal. She hasn't got, you know, the immortal callousness that so many of them have. She is still human and humane with it. And she has real difficulty reconciling those two concepts together.
I'm going to have to read it.
Definitely. definitely. If you liked the first book, don't be put off by any mild spoilers you may have heard about the second book, because actually the second book is way better.
All right. Sorry, I'm convinced.
I wasn't. I mean, I dragged my heels for ages because I was like, right, I'm doing my favourite fairy tales. But no, it's like, no, actually, what you're doing is you are exploring the Persephone myth very much more in detail, very much more cleverly. It was really, really well done. It's one of those books that sort of makes you despair as a fellow writer. It's kind of like, I'm never going to write anything as good as this.
Oh, great. Thanks. I can look forward to that then. Like, I didn't already have enough trouble reading your stuff. I'm despairing, Jules. Thanks.
You can talk.
Oh, shut up. So, death. Big subject. But I guess the thing we can take away from this is that we're all going to die. Death motivates us all differently.
Sorry,
is
that
it
was
a good thing?
That was so cheerfully. We're all going to die.
We might as well be cheerful about it. It's the only thing we all have in common. So
look on the bright side.
That's what I'm taking away from Monty Python.
Yeah.
So it's the joke at the end. It's just they're like, but how did we die? And he points at the fish pie or something like that. And as they're walking away, one person just says, but I didn't even have the fish pie.
So, huge subject, but death actually does go hand in hand with laughter. And, I mean, the thing we haven't really discussed because we don't have time is that the one thing that might possibly be stronger than death is love, if you like. Perfected ideal form of love. Perhaps we'll look at that another time.
Well.
Thank you for joining us for our gallows humour.
Trying to think of something that's not inappropriate to say. But, yeah. Thanks for joining us, and we will catch you again next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.